Welcome to Passive Real Estate Investing, the show where busy people like you learn how to build substantial passive income while creating wealth for the long term. And now, here's your host, Marco Santarelli.
Welcome to another episode of Passive Real Estate Investing. I'm your host, Marco Santarelli, and welcome. If you are a new listener, and there are many of you who listen to the show on a regular basis but have not subscribed, remember to do so. Just click the subscribe link or button wherever that may be from wherever you're listening. If it's on your smartphone, it's usually a little button nearby or to the right of the cover art. So we have an interesting episode today. You know, for the first time in American history, several events are happening and unfolding simultaneously. And when combined, they create a new level of risk and contagion that we've never seen before. You take the factors such as human longevity, an aging population, and really something we've known about for decades, but an unprecedented level of debt and deficit. These things come together to create a serious financial situation or even a crisis. And the worst part is that it's all our fault. I mean, if you really think about it, as a society, we've brought ourselves to this point. And you're going to discover more about this here in today's interview with my guest. But the question is, are you prepared for when a crisis hits? You see, most Americans don't have enough money saved up to cover a medical emergency, never mind retirement. And many assume the reason for this is that they don't make enough money. And while learning how to be more productive with your time and earn more money is part of that equation, the problem is really more complicated. See, the basics of saving and investing are not taught in schools, as we know. We've talked about this many times on the show. So most people go into the workforce, you know, behind the eight ball, lacking education and really not knowing how to make money, invest it, protect it. So, you know, those are the things that we do talk about on the show. But what makes this problem exponentially worse is this thing that you can call a disease called consumerism. And consumerism has spread throughout our culture like wildfire for many decades. Every day we're bombarded with advertisements convincing us to buy things that we don't need. You know, the grand lifestyle we are being pitched is not attainable by the average citizen. It just isn't. And it's not attainable without properly saving and investing. So my guest today basically has a wake-up call for those who want to become wealthy and stay wealthy. It doesn't matter what your background or your age is. It doesn't matter if you desire to work hard or not, but you should work hard. But if you do desire to work hard and you have the discipline to make money, save it, and properly invest it, you will do well. You will not only become wealthy, you will stay wealthy, and you will have the financial freedom and time freedom that you all look for. So I hope you enjoyed today's episode. It's a good one. It's a little bit of a longer one, but let me know what your thoughts are, and we will see you on the other side. Well, it is my pleasure to welcome Paul Dainstrad to the show. He is the founder and CEO of Starpoint Properties, a private real estate firm that he started back in 1990. He has built it into one of the most respected real estate development firms in the industry. And Paul speaks at national conferences all around the country. He has contributed to publications like Forbes, Multifamily Executive, Multi-Housing News, National Real Estate Investor, and Commercial Property News. He is also the author of a new book called Money and Morons, How to Build Wealth and Protect Yourself from the Great Influx. And I have to tell you, I love that title, The Money and Morons. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Marco. Pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you on. I started going through your book, and I intend to not only finish reading it, but get the audiobook so I can listen to it again at just a faster pace. But you've got some very interesting concepts, and you hit certain things dead on, like spot on. So it's very interesting to hear what you have to say about issues that are out there and people talk about, but not at any great length. So before we get started, I had a quick little bio for you. Maybe tell us a little bit more about yourself so people have some context as who you are and what you do.
Sure. You know, grew up in Los Angeles in a real sort of lower to middle income household. And I mentioned it in the book, but, you know, a few issues from when I was younger growing up in my family were very formational. What I mean by that was some sort of traumatic events that made me realize that, you know, securing your future is really, really important. And that requires not only planning, but a real steadfast dedication to saving and building wealth so that you're not vulnerable. because my family was very vulnerable when we were growing up. I mentioned in the book, you know, our roof would leak and I'd have to move around my room in order to avoid the spots where it was leaking while it was raining. And that was a formational event for me. Like, you know what? I don't want to live in a house or an apartment where the roof leaks. So that sort of led me to starting my own business and also realizing how important it is to have financial stability. Because if you're vulnerable, it's very unlikely anyone's going to come and help, including the government. And that's getting more pronounced, which is what, you know, the book is really talking about. The future is probably more vulnerable than we've ever seen it, if we really look at the data and the information that's available.
Yeah, you made an interesting comment because it makes me wonder how many people, especially in their younger years, like early teens, mid-teens, whatnot, realize the importance of creating wealth. They may not call it that at the time. They may call it being rich or riches, which is what I did back in my early teens. But I did realize early on as well that it's very important to create some sort of financial freedom, call it being rich, call it wealth, call it cash flow, call it whatever you may. But for me, that happened around the age of 13, but I really dived into learning about it, teaching myself at the age of 15, 16. And I'm glad I did because I watched friends all around me grow up, you know, going to school, going to the bars, you know, going on dates and doing all this stuff. And they really weren't focused on their financial future, or at least not educating themselves. Maybe they should have had the book Money and Morons back then.
Yeah. I titled the book that way specifically just so that it would have an impact. And I'm pretty direct in the book, as you can see also with the title. And there's a lot of moronic behavior, especially now. And why do I say especially now? You know, the Great Conflux really talks about events that are happening and converging, or that conflux for the first time in history. And what those are debt levels that we've never seen, human longevity that we've never seen, and human aging that we've never seen. When you combine all those things, it just creates a risk paradigm that we've never encountered before, and people aren't planning for it. Especially, as you said, Marco, the younger generation, right? The lowest savings rate in history, and they're going to live the longest that we've ever seen humankind live, right? Average life expectancy used to be 55, you know, 100 years ago. So you would retire at the same time, you know, your life expectancy. So there wasn't much need for retirement or retirement savings, right? Then life expectancy went to 65, same thing, you retired right around that. Now life expectancy is about 75, so you have about 10 years of retirement that you need to save for, what I call NIPI, you know, non-income producing years, you got about 10. This next gen, the generation that's, you know, younger or being born today, they're probably going to live to about 105, right? And if you retire at 65, you've got now 30 years of NIPI, right? Non-income producing years or non-productive years. We've never seen 30 years of retirement. People have, you know, average age, you know, was 75 today. He's going to go to 105. You got to prepare for that. You can't just sort of put your hand in the sand and say, all right, you know what? I'll worry about it later. And then you combine that, the conflux, with massive levels of government debt. A lot of the government programs in 15 years are going to be insolvent, bankrupt. The government has no plans in place. How are they going to deal with that? Every time the issue comes up, they kick the can down the road because it's such a large issue. There's no solution for it. You know, we're seeing it this week, right? There was talk about the government shutting down again, right? Oh, they found another temporary fix and increase of spending. That's not a fix. That's just kicking the can down the road. And what the average American doesn't understand, especially the young Americans, you know, who are going to live longer and need to save more, the government's not going to come and save them. They're not going to have the money. If you don't believe that or don't see it, just pay attention to the debate about the debt. Do you see them providing any solutions, right? Is there any real fix? Or all are they doing is keep increasing the debt ceiling, kicking the can down the road, and saying, you know what, we'll figure it out later. if you see that's what they're doing and there's no fix, you've got to plan for it, because the fix will come in crisis. And there's plenty of data and evidence to support that. Too much debt, if you don't solve it, crisis eventually does. And that's where we're heading.
So, you know, I was curious why you use the word conflux, the great conflux, in your subtitle. But essentially what you're saying is it's the inevitable financial crisis. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. And in your book, you broke that down into three major categories, which you've touched upon. It's the increased longevity, the aging population, astronomical national debt. And really, there's another component, which I want to ask you here a little bit later. But in regards to the aging population and longevity, you know, we're all living longer, and you can see that, and it's great. But is this an issue just because we won't have enough in savings, as in the general population, to survive that long? Or is it a healthcare issue? Or is it both?
It's all of it, right? So we used to have three working people to every one retiree. So we have three working people paying taxes going into the system for every retiree. In 20 years, it's going to flip. We're going to have one working person for every three retirees, right? So our tax system is sort of going to go upside down, right at a time when we have astronomical levels of debt and we need more taxes, we're going to have less. Social Security is going to be back. Okay, so now I'm quoting the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, right? Independent, nonpartisan. It is meant to provide information to Congress so Congress can make good decisions and legislation based on data, right? Not emotions, right? That's part of what the CBO does.
Right.
So CBO says that Social Security will be bankrupt within 10 to 15 years, and they have no solution for it, right?
Yeah.
So the Social Security Trust will be out of money. And it was created, right, to sort of provide retirement savings, right? Well, if the Social Security is not there and people are relying on that for retirement, that's a big issue. Same thing with Medicare, Medi-Cal, right? Medicare is bankrupt in also sort of 10 to 15 years, and our healthcare costs are rising, right? So right at a time when we need Medicare the most, right, because we have an aging population, right, and also, you know, human longevity is going to add to that aging population. Where we need Medicare most, it's going to be bankrupt. What are the two things that add most to our national debt? Social Security and Medicare. Those are the largest components of the national debt. So they're going to be bankrupt. They're the biggest components of our debt, and we have no way of funding them unless we continue to add to the debt, which is what we're doing. So all of that, the conflux, right? All these events coming together that we don't have solutions for, and you know, we're unlikely to solve.
You know, you could argue that we've been so-called kicking the can down the road for literally decades. And will they continue to do that? Yeah, I believe so. I don't know if you've heard this before, but I would guess you've probably heard it 100 times. But the U.S. with the Federal Reserve can print quote unquote money indefinitely. You know, we can continually create the money or the currency that we need to fund these ever-growing social programs and entitlement programs. So do you not see this as just being an ongoing forever kicking the can down the road until there's some sort of global reset or massive forgiveness of debt, you know, nationally or internationally? You know, it's just, you can't get out of it. We've dug a hole so deep, it's impossible to get out of financially, mathematically speaking. But that doesn't mean we, you know, social programs are going to come to an end. If we can continue to print money forever, we'll continue to fund it until it ultimately breaks, like really breaks.
Yeah, right? Crisis, right? When we control our own currency, right, which means that we can keep printing money, and that is a huge benefit. We're also the world's reserve currency, another huge benefit that we have. That's why we've been able to print so much money, why we've got 130% debt to GDP. And that is a really important metric. You know, if you look at a lot of the economists who study national debt or sovereign debt, once you pass 100% debt to GDP, that's a bad metric. We're at 130, heading to 200 really quickly.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, you can keep printing until there's a loss of confidence. And then you either have a monetary collapse or you have a loss of confidence in your bonds and no one wants them anymore because they're worried about a default or a lack of repayment. Right. Or you have inflation because you've printed so much money and you've debased the currency. Right. Either way, I mean, there's crisis can show up in certain few different ways, but crisis still at the end of the day is going to be damaging. So, yeah. We can keep printing until crisis comes, and then that's the day when we can't print anymore. And, you know, crisis is going to force us into some very, very challenging times.
You know, I don't talk about politics on the show, and I always try and avoid it, but you make an interesting comment in the book. In fact, it's an entire chapter, and you refer to the morons being voters, and the voters are the ones who are helping to fuel the fire. Can you explain that? Like, I mean, I see it, you know, because I always say that ignorance is not bliss. Ignorance is expensive. And the fact that ignorance is expensive, you know, means that the decisions you make cause problems, whether right away or deferred down the road. And that's what we see, you know, uneducated voting bloc, which is the majority of the country, is not making decisions in the best interest of our future. However, at the same time, there probably are very few, if any, options out there that are the right options to get us out of the problems that we're creating, like, you know, the deficits and debts, which are a ticking nuclear bomb, et cetera, et cetera. So what would you like to say about the people you're referring to as morons, which are the voting bloc?
Look, I mean, it's sort of, you know, it's a crazy paradox. 88% roughly, depending on which poll you look at, 88% of the public says the debt is an issue and they're worried about it, right? But no one's voting for politicians who want to fix that. Why? The problem is so big, and you said it, Marco. That's a great comment, right? Ignorance is not bliss, right? It is expensive and it's going to be painful, and this is a great situation. The reason 88% of people are worried about the debt, because they know eventually too much debt is going to hurt them. The reason they don't want to fix it and they're not voting for politicians who will fix it, because the only way we can fix it, because it's so large now at 130% debt to GDP, is we've got to raise taxes and we got to lower expenses and we got to lower entitlements, and nobody wants that, right? Everyone wants lower taxes and they want more entitlements. Well, that's moronic behavior, right?
Right.
You know there's a problem, you see there's a problem, but you don't want to fix it because there's going to be a little bit of pain today, right?
Yeah.
Really? So let's just not fix it and have a lot more pain tomorrow. I worry about, Marco, do you have children?
Yes.
Yeah, so do I, right? I've got four children. My four children, they're going to pay for all of this moronic behavior that, you know, our generation and the generation previous to us is creating. And the next generation is just, you know, perpetuating too. There's going to be a payday. It's coming.
So let's get this straight. So we have what you believe to be an inevitable financial crisis looming, coming on the horizon. We don't know if that's a year, 10 years, 50 years from now. And it's being largely perpetuated by the increased longevity, aging population, astronomical national debt levels and entitlement programs and whatnot. So who will be most affected by this?
The lower and middle class, right? The people who don't have savings, who are really, you know, relying on those government entitlement programs for retirement, and they're not going to be there. You know, I'll say it with certainty, and I'm not saying this just from my personal opinion. It's just data, right? The two leading economists who researched this, Reinhardt and Rogoff, right? Harvard-educated economists, very deep thinkers, very deep researchers into this. They wrote a book called This Time is Different, very academically oriented, heavy data. They went back and looked at basically almost 300 years, but let's just talk about the last 100 years of sovereign debt defaults or nations that took on too much debt. And if you look at their research, it's really, really clear. Eventually, debt this time is different, meaning it's not different. What they're telling it was a little bit of a pun, right? Everyone believes that this time is different. We can keep on taking more levels of debt, and it won't harm us. And what they showed was that eventually, every nation that took on more debt eventually had a crisis. Right? That's the path we're on. And so, middle and lower incomes. If you don't have savings, you don't have passive income. You're not going to be self-reliant. You know, we're not saving. We have a disease in this country. It's consumerism, right? You know, I mentioned in the book, you know, we're inundated with anywhere between 1,000 to 5,000 ads a week to teach us to consume and not to save. And that consumerism is a disease, right? The average American doesn't have $1,500. 50% of America doesn't have $1,500 saved for emergency. 50%?
Yeah.
But that's they're going to go out. They're going to go out and buy a $500 purse next month.
It's crazy. The study that you're talking about, the book, I didn't read the book, but I remember the study. And if I am not mistaken, I believe every country that has experienced a financial crisis of sorts, their currency was basically inflated away into essentially nothing. And I don't know if any country has ever been able to escape that path, that downward spiral of like inflating the currency away to nothing. And basically, you could look at the US dollar. If you look at from 1913 on to this point, the dollar is about worth 1 cent relative to what it was worth back when it, you know, first came. Actually, I should say the Federal Reserve came out in 1913. So from that point forward, the US dollar is worth about a penny in real dollar terms compared to what it was back in 1913.
That's absolutely accurate, Marco. Absolutely accurate. When we decoupled from the gold standard, which means that, you know, every time we wanted to print a dollar, we needed to have gold to back that. Why did we decouple from the gold standard back in the Nixon timeframe? Because we wanted to print, right?
That's right.
We wanted to print as much money as we could, and we didn't want to have to back it with gold because we couldn't buy enough gold to do it, right? So, yes, we debased our monetary system, and we're going to see the impact of that. It allowed us to print, but it allowed us to get into these levels of debt out any type of limitations.
What did you find was the most surprising or intriguing to you about your research and in writing this book?
Before I go to that, it's a great question. I want to go back to your comment, because your comment was very, very astute, and I think your listeners need to listen to you on this. And you said it, there's been no country in the history of humankind that's been able to get out of this debt spiral, right? Or what you call the inflationary destruction of just printing money. It's never happened. We are not going to be different. This time is not different. When Jerome Powell, the head of the Federal Reserve, who came out 2 weeks ago, which is very uncommon. He's supposed to be non-political, and he has a mandate as the head of the Fed. When he came out 2 weeks ago and he said, right, that our debt levels are unsustainable, and if we don't do something about it, we're going to have a real problem. And he said, we need to have an adult conversation. The adult conversation is verbatim. This is the head of the Federal Reserve, you know, telling the American people, and warning us, and we're still not listening, right? So, yeah, your comment was astute. I want to really highlight that. And what I've learned, we're not going to solve this problem, right? Congress is not going to solve this problem. Politicians are not going to solve this problem. Voters are not going to solve this problem. You have to prepare yourself and your family and your children. And if you don't, when the crisis comes, and you don't have the proper resources and the savings and passive income, it's going to be very, very challenging.
That's actually a perfect segue into kind of like the conversation I want to have with you about essentially the second half of your book, being more productive, saving, and more importantly, investing. But I don't want to leave that question I just asked you hanging, you know, about what was most surprising or intriguing to you in your findings when you were doing your research and writing the book.
I think I mentioned it, that we're not going to solve this problem.
Oh, right? Interesting.
Right? That's the moron part, right? It's sort of what they call normalcy normalcy bias, right? It's a psychological term where like people need to feel normal. They can't be in an abnormal state for too long. They can't function properly. And this is the normalcy bias, right? The problem is down the road, right? And I don't want to suffer today for a problem that's, you know, in the future. And I want someone else to solve it for me, right? These are all versions of normalcy bias. So when I saw that, and then 88% of the population says, this debt's a problem. I am worried about it, but then won't fix it, right, through the most powerful mechanism they have, which is their vote. Mm-hmm. There's politicians out there who will fix it, right? They'll increase taxes and they'll lower expenses, right? But no one wants that, right? They want an easy fix. There's no more easy fixes, right? This is going to be a painful fix now, but less painful today than tomorrow. So that was just shocking. And it was sort of like, oh my God, we're not going to solve this. We're really not going to solve it. We all see it, the problem coming. We're all worried about it, 88% of us. And we know we can't take on too much debt at the personal level or the national level, but we're not going to solve it, right? And then I was like, oh shit, crisis is going to solve this for us, right? Then what's crisis going to look like, right? You know,
I don't think we know what
made my head spin. You know, you ever seen that emoji where like the emoji where your head explodes, the top of your head just coming off? That's what I felt like after doing all the research. And sort of like, wow, that was the most surprising thing.
Yeah, I'm of the belief that if there is a fix. It's going to be very ugly. It's not going to be favorable to most people. It'll be a very painful process. And I'm talking painful in the sense that it could be generational, meaning that there will be multiple generations who have to essentially, quote unquote, suffer through the adoption of the fix in order to get on out to the other side of it, you know, smelling like roses. Because it's not going to be fixed in one generation. It's just probably impossible, financially, mathematically impossible to roll back or get out of the hole that we're in. That's just my take.
No, you're right. And your take, there's an enormous amount of data and support for your opinion. So I try to really, you know, take out the hysteria and the emotion from this conversation, even though I keep talking about crisis. And the way you take the emotion and hysteria out of it, just look at the hard data, right? Look at the facts, look at history, right? Look at the logic behind it. And your opinion is really supported by that logic, by that data, by that history.
So I guess, you know, flipping this around and let's, you know, look at the silver lining, the bright side of this, you know, let's talk about how do we solve this problem personally? Because I can't control the economy. I can't control the national economy or the world economy, but I can control my own personal economy. That's the only thing I have control over. It's my personal economy. So let's talk about being more productive. Let's talk about, you know, the art of financial discipline that you refer to as saving. And then lastly, you know, let's talk about investing, which is really how you secure your financial future. And then I want to ask you about real estate because you're in real estate. I'm in real estate. You know, that's been kind of the center of my world for the longest time. So why don't we start with, you know, how do we solve this problem individually for ourselves personally and be more productive? You could take it however you want.
Sure. You know, people want like this brilliant new idea to solve this problem. And it's not a brilliant new idea. It's not my idea, right? I've learned from my mentors, which Warren Buffett is one of them. And if people will just listen to him, he's one of the wisest, you know, his wisdom is incredible, right? Wisdom is different than intelligence. He's just a wise man. And not everyone's listening to him, but those of us who do, right, stop spending so much, save, and invest, right? Stop, get over the disease of consumerism because Gucci and Prada, they want to take every last penny they can from you. They don't care if you're bankrupt, right? Because they're making a fortune off of you. And what are all those executives doing? Well, all those owners doing all those shareholders are doing, they're saving and investing with your money that you're buying that Prada purse or shoes. It's madness. Stop. Save that money and invest. And then, you know what the eighth wonder of the world is, according to Einstein?
Compounding interest.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, good. Marco, you well read. Yeah. Einstein said it great, the best. The eighth wonder of the world is the power of compounding. What does that mean? When you save and invest and that investment starts compounding, it's amazing what happens, right? In 20 or 30 years, you have a lot of savings. You've got passive income. You've got security. You've got stability. And when the great conflict hit, you're not going to be one of the victims of it. You'll actually probably be able to capitalize from it. Because when that crisis comes, my guess is, you know, except for certain investment classes or investment products, asset values are going to drop 80%. And the people who have savings and are going to be able to invest are going to be able to buy an 80% reduction in pricing. That's how one way the Rockefellers got so rich was, you know, in the Great Depression, when asset values dropped 80%, the market, you know, the stock market dropped, you know, 60%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They were buying things. They had capital. They were ready for the crisis, and they become extraordinarily wealthy from it.
Yeah, that is a smart strategy. And I have to imagine that they had savings or deployable capital available in order to do that, to take advantage of that, you know, that drop or that dip. But you said it before, you know, the average American has less than $1,500 in savings. So even if there was a recession or a correction like that, the, you know, they wouldn't be able to pull the trigger and acquire very much. So, you know, that goes back to the whole thing about what we just mentioned about being more productive. You know, the question, and maybe this is, you know, a subject that's beyond the scope of this conversation, but, you know, how do you become more productive in order to save more, in order to invest more? You know, it's kind of like it's like a chain or dominoes.
You know, and that's, again, you know, I mentioned this in the book. This is sort of the part of the moronic thinking we have now. You heard of quiet quitting?
I'm not sure I have.
Yeah. Quiet quitting is an actually really popular term. It was a top 10 Google searched term about a year ago. And quiet quitting is the concept of when you're at work, do the bare minimum that you can, right? You've almost quit, but you haven't told anybody. And you're just going to do the most bare minimum, right? Quiet quitting is a very popular term now amongst a certain cohort, because their concept is, why work hard, right? It's moronic, right? Who's going to get promoted and get a raise? The quiet quitter or the person at work who's working hard and making a real contribution and going above and beyond? No. They're going to get the promotion and they're going to get the raise. The quiet quitter is either going to get fired or going to get stuck, right?
Right.
There's already data here now working from home, right? Right. 80% of the people working from home are vulnerable right now, right? Because there's data showing that most people who are working from home are not the people who are working really, really hard, right? They're trying to do the bare minimum. They're not going to get the raises. They're not going to get the promotions. They're going to be the first people laid off. Another moronic concept, right? So the basic to what I'm saying to you, Marco, is work hard, right? I've had almost three jobs my entire life, right? I am wealthy now. You know, I went from poverty and, you know, working three jobs, not being able to pay my rent, to now I'm super wealthy, but I still have three jobs. I still have three income sources. So stop spending. Get out of the disease of consumerism, save, invest, work hard, even if that means two or three jobs. Listen to what Warren Buffett says. Before you buy a home, make sure you have a second income, right? Take that money and invest it into productive assets. A home is not a productive asset. A home is a liability. A home doesn't create income. A home requires you to have income, right? A home is a cash suck. And homes are great. I'm not saying it's the American dream, right? Mm-hmm. I think in some ways it's the American whole, but Let's just, you know, follow the fantasy. It's the American dream. Okay, that's fine. You want to reach the American dream? Make sure you have enough savings first. Make sure you have two incomes and some of that's passive. And then chase the American dream. I'd rather see you, instead of, you know, buying a home that has no income, right? Buy a duplex, rent both of those out, have that income come in, right? Versus necessarily buying a home that has no income.
Yeah.
If you're going to buy a home, build an ADU in the backyard, right? So now you have a unit in your backyard that's giving you income. That's passive income, right? That's a second source of income. That's where you can start compounding and you can start investing. So those are some of the ideas I lay out, but these ideas have been around for 100 years.
So as far as investing goes, what, and of course, this is not financial advice in any way, what either one of us say, but what are your favorite investments? If there's more than one, what would you say or suggest or recommend people focus on? And if it's different than what your favorites are, what are your favorites?
So, you know, one of the reasons I went into real estate, and probably you went into real estate as well, is that it's a very good protection for inflation, right?
Yep.
And all this money printing is very inflationary. And eventually, you know, that's going to catch up. So real estate is probably one of the best investments for an inflationary environment. So that's one of the reasons I liked it. But it's also really, really tax efficient. You know, real estate investors pay very low taxes because of depreciation. And then also we're allowed to, you know, to go at 1031 exchanges. So we can make profit and exchange that. So it's really, really tax efficient. And it's a productive asset, generates income, right? And then you could also influence that income, right? So you can build an expertise where you can increase that income, what we call value add real estate. So for all those elements, I really, really like real estate. In the stock market, I like index funds, but you know, that's the Warren Buffett philosophy, and he's right. You know, if you're gonna invest in the stock market, put it in an index fund, low costs, not a lot of overhead, and they'll beat the market. You know, I just published a white paper. Marco, what percentage of fund managers or wealth managers or, you know, hedge funds over a 10-year period beat their averages or beat the market?
Good question. I'd probably say that, this is a wild guess, but I'd say it's probably a wash if you're taking a 10-year horizon. They probably average out to be similar to what the index fund is.
95% of the experts, so fund managers, hedge funds, wealth managers, all 95% of them underperform an index. Only 5% beat, let's say, the S&P 500. They underperform once you include their fees. So, yeah, you just an index fund, you're going to do much better. They're liquid and they're easy to get out of too. So I really like index funds. But that, again, that's Warren Buffett teaching us. And he's one of the most astute investors on the planet. We need to listen to him. And then what else do I like? At this current moment, I'm very defensive. You know, everything's sort of peaking. Stock market, commodities, everything's sort of at high levels. And one of the reasons for that is, you know, there was so much stimulus from the government thrown into the system because of COVID, right? And all of that, what I call heroin, came into the market and just pumped everything up. So I can't say I love anything today, but over the long term, which is what I was referring to in my previous comments about real estate or index funds, those are what I like over the long term. I wouldn't necessarily think that anyone should be, you know, investing deeply today. Waiting for a correction is probably smart.
Yeah, I have a hard time seeing myself jumping into index funds or the stock market as a whole. You know, is it going to continue to appreciate? Maybe, possibly, depends on how much easing and, you know, money is put into the system by the Fed. You know, how much do we juice the economy? It's an election year. I'm sure there's going to be some of it this year, you know, just to prop up the market. So, you know, that might be a bullish thing. But for me, I'm bullish primarily on residential real estate because of the fundamentals, you know, the dynamics there of having strong demand. And in most areas of the country, short supply is going to continue to support price levels, both rental and sales prices. Commercial is something that I've really never been a big fan of, but I see it suffering for the short term, especially with retail. So, you know, I'm not a big fan on the commercial side, at least not right now, but I've always been a residential fan. You know, we all need a roof over our head and a place to live. And, you know, if you're in a good market, in a desirable area, strong neighborhood, it's hard to screw up real estate. It's a very forgiving asset class, in my opinion, when you invest properly. So I'm definitely bullish on residential real estate. A little skittish or defensive, as you would say, in most other sectors and areas. But yeah, I mean, you know, that's what we talk about on the show a lot is you know, the power of real estate, why it's such a great investment. It's an inflation hedge. It's a cash flow generator. It creates passive income long term. It can appreciate. It protects your wealth. It builds equity. It has the tax benefits. I mean, it's everything you and I know and love about real estate. So for me, it's definitely the go-to. And it's available to most everybody. You know, you don't have to be an accredited investor to invest directly in real estate. So it's accessible to most people.
Absolutely. It's sort of the 10,000 hour rule, you know, which means that, you know, you got to spend about 10,000 hours to build a specialty or an expertise in any industry.
Yeah.
But if you spend 10,000 hours learning real estate, really learning real estate, you will become rich. There is just no question about it. But build the expertise, really understand what you're doing, understand your markets, build your network, build your connections, get access to more capital, just not your own. And once you have that expertise, as you said, Marco, it's very brilliant on your part. It's accessible, right? And yeah. Nothing is stopping you from doing it, except, you know, if you'd rather just sit on a couch and watch another show, which, you know, too many Americans want to do. I hate to be that direct, but, you know, if 50% of, we're the richest country on the planet. And then not only that, per capita, we're the richest country in history, right? Per capita. But 50% of Americans have zero savings and don't have $1,500 for a medical emergency. How is it possible?
Well, we talked about it. It's consumerism, lack of education, ignorance.
And a mentality that's starting to creep in of, you know, working hard is stupid, right? This is quiet quitting, right? Why is working hard stupid? That used to be the fabric of America, right? We would work hard and we were proud, yeah. Right?
Yeah, that's exactly it.
And I was listening to a celebrity last week. I'm not going to use any names, but, you know, they made this quote that I feel bad for Americans who have to work so hard. I was like, what? What are you talking about? Okay, you're a celebrity. You're making about $50 million a year from all your advertising stuff. But the average American can't do that. So what right. You're telling them is don't work hard. Oh, okay, just sit on the couch and be broke and vulnerable, right? And when the great conflict comes, you're going to be fine, celebrity, right? You got $100 million in savings. But the poor American who you just said that you feel bad and they shouldn't have to work hard, what are they going to know? It's just nonsense.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, I agree. So I guess in wrapping up, and you've already touched upon this, but let me ask you this, because this is kind of like one of those takeaway things. Actually, I'll break it down into two parts. If you could provide people listening to this some practical strategies or tips, I mean, you've talked about real estate, obviously. What are some practical strategies or tips that individuals can implement starting right away or this year that will align their financial decisions?
So like, here's one thing, right? How do you take advantage from a government that's just printing money, right? You got to try to benefit from that. So we have the SBA, and I have this in the book, and you can go into the book and get a little bit deeper with it, but we have the Small Business Administration. You know, the Small Business Administration has a program that anybody with a credit rating, basically above 700, can automatically get an SBA loan, right? All you need is the credit rating. That's it, right? You don't need income. You don't even need to show tax returns. You don't even need to show you have a job, right? So the first thing I'd say is protect your credit. If it's low, you can get it higher, right? So protect your credit, go get an SBA loan, which is easy to get. The average American can get it. Take that $150,000, because it caps out at about $150,000, and go invest that, right? Right? Build an expertise. Spend 10,000 hours in something so you've got a real expertise. Take that $150,000 and turn it into $1.5 million, and you can. You can. Just apply all the fundamentals that so many of our past mentors have taught us. So that's one way you can align, right, your financial incentives. So just one small example, but there's a lot of other things that can be done, right? Back to what you're saying, right? Second and third jobs.
No, that's great. You just got my head thinking here. You know, if you can get $100, $150,000 from the SBA at a low rate and you have high credit already to be able to get that, then there's a good probability that you could use that SBA loan as down payment capital to acquire income producing real estate, even if it's zero cash flow in the short term. At least it gets you into the game or leveling up in your real estate investing portfolio. I hate to say it's almost going to be like 100% financing, but if the numbers work, if it makes sense, you know, you can certainly get started or level up your real estate investing by using that. So, and this is not financial advice. I'm not suggesting anybody go out and do that, but I mean, I'm here thinking, how can I take advantage of that SBA loan as down payments towards additional real estate, right? So
yeah, take that $150,000, go buy a 10-unit apartment building, live in one of the units. So now you're living almost rent-free. There's an opportunity cost, I recognize that, but you're living rent-free. Yeah. You're going to manage the other 9 units, and that's all going to bring you income, and that will have positive cash flow. Even today, if you did that with that $150,000 and you lived in there with your family and you managed that building, you're going to get about a 5% return on that $150,000, which means that, you know, 5% on $150,000, if you start making that every year and you save it, letting that compound, and then in 5 years, you take all that money and that comp, or 10 years, you take all that money that compounded and you buy another apartment building.
Right? Yep.
It works. It's an age old strategy. Yep. So again, back to Einstein, the eighth wonder of the world is, you know, the power of compounding. That's just one example of it again. Right?
Yeah. Paul, this has been great. I mean, there's so many more things that I'm sure we could talk about and rabbit holes we can go down. But for the sake of time, we should probably just wrap it up here. Tell our listeners how they can either follow you, get more information, get a hold of the book, etc.
Yeah, the book's available on Amazon, and just some shameless self-promotion. It just became a bestseller, so it's resonating with certain people. So it's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You just Google it, you know, easy to get it there. There's an audio version, as you mentioned, Marco. And they can follow me on Instagram or Twitter under my name, Paul Donishrod. And also, we post onto my company's website too a lot of my material and work product and white papers, and that's starpointproperties.com.
Perfect. And I'll put links to that in the show notes and on our website so everybody can see that there as well. Well, Paul, once again, thank you for taking the time today. I appreciate it. And this has been wonderful. So hopefully a lot of people will go out and grab your book and read it, because it's a great book.
Thank you, Marco. I appreciate you having me, and your audience is lucky to have you. I really hope they listen to you, because if they do, I know in 20 years they're going to come back and thank you. I just hope they do.
Thank you so much. And likewise with you, Paul. Thank you.
All right.
Hope you enjoyed today's episode. It was definitely interesting, and some of those subjects and topics I could have gone much longer on and much more in depth. But for the sake of time, I just had to kind of wrap it up at the 1 hour mark. Anyway, that is it for today's show. If you're interested in passive income that is not real estate related in the form of promissory notes, don't forget that at Norada Capital, NoradaCapital.com, our private equity firm, we offer promissory notes that offer 12% and 15% interest per year, paid monthly. So it's an annual rate of return that's 15%. It can be more, but it's a fixed rate of return. It's monthly interest payments. If you want more information, simply go to our website at NoradaCapital.com, and you can fill out the form and get some more information. that is it for today. Remember to subscribe if you haven't done so. Send me any questions about real estate that you have. My team and I will answer it, and I may even cover it on the show. Visit us on iTunes. Leave us a rating and review. I greatly appreciate it. And that's it. Thank you for listening. I will see you all on our next episode.
Are you having a hard time finding great investment properties? Unfortunately, the best deals are rarely found locally. Successful investing begins with the right properties in the right markets. Norada Real Estate provides everything you need to invest in the best deals across the U.S. Our simple, proven system will help you create real wealth and passive monthly cash flow. Get your free copy of The Ultimate Guide to Passive Real Estate Investing at noradarealestate.com/guide. That's noradarealestate.com/guide. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate legal, tax, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please contact the host.